welcome to this, of course, the latest edition of No Filter Sports. It is July 16th, 2020. Eli Zarrett here along with Bob Page and Denny McClain. We're all Zooming together. And come up a little bit later, we're going to talk to, should I say a hero of the 84 team, Johnny Grubb? He was a participant.
Well, I don't know about maybe, a hero, but you know, I mean, maybe he was one of the better players.
Johnny Grubb appeared in three different playoff series for the Detroit Tigers. That's all. Do you know what his lifetime postseason batting average is?
I don't
know. 429. So if you want to call him a hero, go ahead and call him
a hero.
Was it?
I mean, it was 4-for-7 in the series that year, but
yeah,
the
postseason record was remarkable. Three different series.
And I believe, and this is just my opinion, that his hit in game two of the playoffs against the Royals was the biggest moment in the 84 season. The reason I say that is this. They were going to beat the Padres anyway. They were much better.
But are you talking about the double?
Yes, I'm talking about the two-run double when it was tied 3-3 in game two. They had won game one, and in the 11th inning off the great Dan Quisenberry hit a two-run double that won the game 5-3. That basically killed off Kansas City. And Kansas City had been the dominant team in the AL West. They've been to the World Series. They won it the next year in 85. They'd been to the playoffs. They beat the Yankees in the playoffs in the 80s. And they were favored. And that one put it out. And as I talked to John yesterday to line this up, I don't know if I've told this story before, tell me, but I'll tell it again anyway. I was at that game, game two. If he hit the two-run double and they won the game, as soon as it ended, I ran to the elevator to go down to the locker room, and I held the door open because running down the hallway, running and almost jumping with joy were Jim Campbell and Bill LaJoy, two of the more dour people.
Okay, I could see LaJoy doing that despite the fact that Jim he's a Campbell, heavy cigarette addict. Jim Campbell running anywhere,
Jim
now
Campbell,
you are a lion.
On, he was giggling. He was like a teenager. He was so excited. I told Johnny, I'll never forget the look on Campbell's face. He was in a state of ecstasy. And, of course, it was a dramatic game. They knew the Royals were the toughest team they'd face. And that's why I think that was the biggest moment. And
it was one of the worst managing jobs in the history of baseball.
Yeah, by who?
Yeah, got Quisenberry out there. Johnny Grubbs was a left-handed hitter.
Right.
Why would he be pitching to Grubbs? He shouldn't have been. They should have brought in the right way you play the game, bring in a left-hander. Grubbs would have probably been taken out of the game. And Chet Lemon was the next hitter. So I got to take my chance with the righty versus righty versus this guy trying to hit up because he was a good hitter against left-handed pitching.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Quisenberry had a
ball. But, you know, your point is well taken, Denny.
Yeah.
But you don't know what the lifetime records were of those guys. I mean, you know, who knows how somebody hit Dan Quisenberry or Johnny Grubb did against a particular pitcher. I think they had that technology back then, even without computers.
But Quisenberry. But yeah. Quisenberry, 80% of the time, hit against a right-handed pitcher.
Yeah.
Faced many right-handers. So, yeah. You know, he was equipped. It was like Gates Brown. Gates wanted to hit against everybody except hard-throwing left-handers. Same thing with our guy here, too.
Yeah. Did you guys ever meet or interview Dan Quisenberry?
No.
I think I met him
one of the finest people I ever knew in baseball. Anytime the Royals were in town, I went straight into the locker room, do something with Quiz after the game. What a nice guy he was. And what a tragic life and a tragic death. Oh, God.
Yeah. What happened to his wife?
No, to Quisenberry.
He died of cancer.
Yeah,
brain cancer. Yeah. We'll talk to Johnny Grubb a little bit later on about the 84 team, whether it impacted his life and all that good stuff. So looking forward to that. You know, where do I start here? The most interesting conversation I've had sports regarding, I think you guys will appreciate this. This morning I talked with George Karras. George Karras is Alex Karras's son, who I happen to know, and I do some business with. In fact, he owns a company that does some service to my house. And very interesting what he said. He's going to give the speech this summer, in November when they have the Hall of Fame induction. I go, what a shame, because we had talked about this on our show, didn't we? We mentioned Marvin Miller was put in after he died. Recently, we were talking about somebody. Right. Bob, you were mentioning somebody who they did something for, and why'd they wait till he died, like the year after he died? I forget what it was with, but what a shame with him. And George said that Alex told him when he was dying, he had a terrible death, he died of dementia. and it was colon cancer that killed him. All that the treatment ruined his kidneys. And his quote was, he was so funny. He said to his son, "I don't dislike the idea of dying. I just don't want to be around when it happens."
Can I interject a couple of things real quick?
Yep.
What's a longhorn?
It's a type of steer. It's a piece of steer.
Number two. What's a Tar Heel?
Bob,
I asked a question because I got a story.
I'm going to answer the question. You ask a question. I'm trying to answer it. Here's how that nickname came about.
Bob, I know how it came about. I'm going to do that, but no, I don't.
You asked me what a Tar Heel was. I'm trying to explain.
Just say. Do you know what it is or it isn't?
Yes, I do.
Yes, you do.
Okay, I don't, Denny. You tell me what it is.
Let me tell you something. Well, a Tar Heel is somebody just from North Carolina, period. That's all it is. And here's the bottom line. Both of these teams are going to have their names changed. They think somehow it attacks the Indians.
Not the Longhorn. How would
The Longhorns and the Tar Heels.
No.
They're getting ready to vote on it. They're getting ready to do it. Why? I have no, but think about it. The Tar Heels is only somebody from North Carolina.
Well, I think
now I am going to answer your question since you don't have the complete answer. You don't have a complete answer. Here's where the nickname came from.
Let him finish, Denny. You tried.
Bob.
You tried. Now Bob's going to finish. I say, go ahead, Bob.
Denny, this came from a well-known Civil War battle won by the Confederates and carried by the North Carolina boys. And somebody said when that was over in the front of a Yankee charge, them boys from North Carolina stood like they had tar on their heels. So that's why they're called the Tar Heels. And it's a Civil War reference. So that could explain what it does explain why they want to get rid of any reference.
No, it doesn't.
Yes, it does.
No, it doesn't. Because a Tar Heel's either a ram. They really are. From? It's a ram or a sheep. That's what a Tar Heel is in North Carolina.
Alex Karras to this, but now the Longhorn one.
I just give up.
There has to be something else with the Longhorn. It has to be something else because that doesn't make any sense.
And additionally, I don't think that there is any indication that the Texas Longhorns are changing their name. There's just a discussion about the Texas Longhorns renaming.
I don't know what everybody's trying to stop me from bringing this story up, but they are. I'm sorry, guys. I don't want to ruin your breakfast, lunch, or dinner, but they are. They are discussing it.
We believe you. Now, Brandon,
make this up.
No. We believe you. Brandon, what were you saying? Please continue.
Go ahead, Brandon. Thank you.
They're trying to rename the Texas Longhorn football field, not the team name.
Yes. Is there a difference?
it's just an important detail.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, Danny is going to do his best imitation of Detroit's own Gilda Radner as Emily Latella.
Never mind.
I heard that the National Association of Longhorns, headed by a steer with one of the steers with the highest IQ, says that we resent being used as a mascot for this team. So it's a class action suit. Oh man, listen. I'm glad we can laugh because I've had a hard time laughing lately.
How can you not?
The world is a mess. The sports world is a mess. Yes, I'm excited to watch the Memorial beginning today. Tiger is his return after 5 months. As weird as it's going to be, he was in a practice round Tuesday. He had a 250-yard iron up the hill within 8 feet of the cup, and one guy about 100 yards away clapped. And he said it was going to be very strange because, you know, Tiger, if you saw the scene, if you remember the scene when he won the FedEx Championship the year before last, and they had to have the ropes, and thousands of people following him at East Lake to the 18th green. I can watch golf and I can watch MMA, but I don't really much. Some sports like that can kind of work without fans, but we'll see. Everybody's groping here. Everybody doesn't know how it's going to work out. We don't know whether college football is going to play. Is fans, no fans. It's just a mess, and such a mess. This is the funniest of all, okay? The NBA has got 113-page protocol. Unfortunately, it requires the players to read it. They're going to get takeout food and leave without. They're too busy playing video games and doing all kinds of and managing their Twitter feed, and nobody's reading the protocol. It's just ludicrous. I'm tired of waiting around. You know, it's just when we talk about the minutia.
Who starts next week? Baseball.
Huh? And baseball starts next the 23rd week, or 24th. They start.
Well, I got a question for you guys then about this. In fact, you just touched on a bunch of things I want to bring up again, Eli. But on Wednesday, they ran, and Denny knows this, he's become our resident NASCAR expert. They ran an all-star race won by Chase Elliott, son of the man with one of the greatest nicknames in the entire history of the world, Awesome Bill from Dawsonville. Bill Elliott, the retired NASCAR racer. Uh-huh. So this track at Bristol, Tennessee, seats 70,000, and they had 20,000 fans in it. 20,000 were there yesterday. Yeah, so what they did was they made fans wear masks to their seats. Then you could take them off. I mean, how else are you going to drink beer? So why not, Eli and Denny and Brandon? Why not Real Sports too? Michigan Stadium seats 105,000 people. Yeah. How come you can't have 40 or 50,000 people in that stadium with social distancing? You wear masks to your seats and it's all good. How come you can't?
Well, I think, that's a great point.
I suspect they're going to do that.
I think we'll see they're going to have, there's testing, no way they're going to play college football. But, they're testing
NASCAR right now. If the thing goes well with NASCAR, and I don't know how it can, that in fact, you'll see an awful lot of teams open up with attendance right away. And then we'll have another surge.
I don't know about that, Denny.
But here's the deal.
I don't know if we'll have another surge at all. And I highly doubt that anybody's going to die from going to the NASCAR race. 20,000 people in a 70,000-seat stadium.
Do you think anybody thought they were going to die or get the virus when they were in that bar over in Lansing?
Not initially, but after that.
But we're making an assumption, though.
People recognize they were in danger.
We're making an assumption that they're actually going to wear their masks.
Well, many places,
masks are a rule, and they don't wear it. So, this whole – everything that we're talking about here in the NBA, like we say, starts in the 30th and baseball next week. Is it all doomed because of the inevitability of infection rates? What infection rate really does that mean in terms of the safety of healthy young people? How interesting will it be with no fans and players wearing masks? How legitimate will it appear to be because of all these rule changes? And how will that impact how seriously people take all of it? So I'm curious to see, just like I would gawk, although I don't do it, I don't gawk at train wrecks and car wrecks out of respect for the people who are spilled all over the highway. But I do have a curiosity factor here to look, but I just can't get gung-ho about anything.
Okay, Bob, it's peculiar what you said a few seconds ago. 135,000 people are dead, and they say from this virus. You implied that these people, because they're going to a race, aren't going to get the virus.
I'm not going there with you again.
I'm not either. With you again. But you implied.
No, you are. You're bringing it up again. I'm not going there. No, here's what I want to talk about.
What you said, nobody will die. But if people don't wear their masks or they take them off and sneeze, it could be awful. We don't know.
Okay, look, guys, I'm going to say this. I want to move on here. We know basically who's been dying of this pandemic, the same as in every pandemic. If you're in any kind of danger at all, don't you dare go to a NASCAR race or a Michigan or Michigan State football game. Now, what I wanted to get to, Eli, was something you just now talked about and you mentioned earlier.
Let
him finish.
Hang on a minute. So I can't comment on this anymore. It's over.
I'm tired of it, and the listeners are tired of it too. Stop beating this stuff to death.
Make your last point, Denny.
Never mind. Go ahead. No. Bob, the conflict here that I have with you is that you don't understand. There's a lot of people that call and text us every week that tell us that they don't like it when you imply that people don't die or this is a.
Wait till I read something in the mailbag for you, pal. But I don't want to because I'm tired of going there.
Bob, I think one of the problems we have here is the whole mask controversy, which shouldn't be a controversy at all. Right. If people wore their masks, it would protect and it could certainly help. There are people that believe and criticize this.
I think it has. Yeah,
sure.
Well, yeah, but there's still half the country. Yeah. And our president won't endorse wearing masks. Okay. And the whole thing is ludicrous how it's come.
Now,
can
I get back to the golf comment?
Of course. Yes, go ahead.
So, at any rate, I want both of you. You guys are the big golfers and the golf experts. Mark Canizero wrote an interesting piece today. I think, as some of you know, he's the golf writer of the New York Post. And he was talking about the drama in last week's PGA Tour event, which Eli and Denny both saw. Mm-hmm. He wrote, Sunday on the first playoff hole, Justin Thomas buries a 50-foot putt for birdie, and the 10,000 fans surrounding the green erupt for several minutes. Now, Colin Morikawa, faced with a 25-foot birdie putt of his own, has to make it to extend the playoff while rattled by the ear-piercing noise. Now, we know, of course, there were no fans surrounding the green at all. That didn't happen. So in relative silence, Morikawa made that 25-footer. He extended the playoff, and he won the tournament. Rory McIlroy said afterward, it probably would have taken Colin an extra 2, 3, 4, 5 minutes to hit that putt just to let everybody settle down. I definitely think that putt that Colin made, he happened to make it on top of Justin, was a little easier because he didn't have to deal with 10,000 people around the green having to settle down. And Tiger added that with fans present, the Morikawa putt would have been a lot more difficult because of the energy of the fans. Morikawa admitted that too. So this is what we're seeing with no spectators on the PGA Tour.
But well, let's go ahead.
With all due respect, I played in a lot of situations. The bases were loaded, two men on, the winning run is looking me in the face and what have you. I never recall that kind of a feeling. Adrenaline's got nothing to do with it. You know, the idea of having to do this or do that when you got to just rely upon your ability and your experience. I mean, it's kind of crazy to think of what you just said. I mean, there was nobody there to begin with. But the bottom line, we'd all like to see people there. We all do. I mean, I know Eli and I do. But, I mean, there's no difference the way you play when there's a big crowd. If you're an experienced guy. I'm not talking about somebody who just gets out of their car and walks in front of 20,000 people on the first tee. There's nothing worse in the world.
I think you're both right in a sense. I have no opinion.
I want your opinion.
Listen, if that's what Rory McIlroy says, and he's been there before, I certainly can't say that he's wrong. But it works both ways, because by the same token, you don't have the crowd to fire you up. You don't have the crowd to carry you through. And so, you know, whether the crowd is there or not there, I think it affects it both ways. But let me ask you something as a player.
But wait a minute. Wait, before you move on, let me ask you something as a player. And you've become a pretty good player. 11, 12 handicaps, pretty good. It really is. My question to you is, when you're out there and you play a lot and you hit a real good shot, aren't you in a little bit of a hustle to get to the next shot? It gets you going, doesn't it?
Yeah. That's my point,
crowd or not.
Yeah.
And another thing about this, Eli and Denny, I do know a lot about basketball, and I watch a lot of basketball. And if you see these guys, the guy gets a shot, just unthinkingly goes up, and the odds are at the NBA level he's going to make it. How often do you see when a guy gets a pass, he's totally wide open?
Yeah.
He's got a couple seconds to think about that shot now, and he chokes on it. So this is what Mark Cannizzaro is writing about today. What if Morikawa had 4 or 5 minutes more to think about that putt?
Wouldn't have made any difference.
Okay.
It may or may not have. Yeah. Listen, those are all intellectual exercises that are interesting, but I don't know.
And at times I'm a little bit offended every time somebody misses a shot, somebody says, well, he choked. You just make bad shots, bad pitches, bad foul balls, all of that stuff. It's part of the game.
I know you got some thoughts about Casey Mize. I want to get those in a minute. But first, I want to welcome again and tell you about our two new sponsors, starting with Feldman Automotive, which is Michigan's number one Chevy dealer and also number one pre-owned car dealer in Michigan. Also, it's 1-800-PRE-OWNED Supercenter located in Waterford. 7 other locations, 5 Chevy dealers in Novi, New Hudson. You got Lansing, Livonia, Highland. There's a Chevy dealer near you. You got Feldman Hyundai of New Hudson, Kia of Novi. You got Feldman Woodhaven. So there's a Feldman dealership or used a certified pre-owned vehicle near you. And we encourage you to support our sponsors so they will stay with us. Almost any pre-owned car comes with exclusive drive it for 3 days. Love it or bring it back. So we stand behind Feldman. If you're looking for a newer pre-owned shop, Feldman, let us know. Even give us some feedback. I want you to support the show, support our sponsors with those 9 locations, guaranteed credit approval. Also buy online at FeldmanAuto.com, hassle-free at home or in the showroom. Also encourage you to look into Power Home Solar if you're thinking about alternate energy and safe energy, green energy, based right here in Detroit, America's fastest growing solar energy company. All their panels made in the United States. You save money, you help save the environment, and also avoid power outages as they've now teamed up with Generac, nation's largest provider of in-home backup battery and generator systems. So lower your energy bills, eliminate power outages forever. The owner there is Jason Waller of Power Home Solar. Financing starting at $99 a month. Call them at 1-800-POWER-90. Save an additional $1,800. Support our guys. They will continue to support us. You're listening to the No Filter Sports Podcast. Well, baseball is up next week. Read that You see, I feel so, we talked about it the other day. I don't want to repeat it, but it's so hard to cover spring training. And now this makes it even worse because you don't have former players there. You don't have a lot of coaches yet to talk to. You know, the conversations are minimal. So you got these poor writers trying to cope with stories. And I guess the big story is that Casey Mize struck out Spencer Torkelson on Tuesday. I don't mean to laugh, but I mean, what could be more meaningless than a batter striking out in simulation?
He's a big power hitter. He's going to strike out a lot anyway.
but Denny, who's knows a little bit about a little more about pitching than we do, you say you're concerned about young Mize, who may or may not make the rotation.
I watched them throw three or four pitches, and the most they put on TV that night, and he sets up well. Fundamentally, he sets up well. He has a nice turn, and the next thing you see, he's standing straight up when he releases the ball. That will put so much pressure eventually over a period of time on his elbow and his shoulder. One of the two are going to go, either the elbow or the shoulder. And the shoulder, I suspect, because that's where a lot of guys, if they're not following through, it's like a golf swing to some degree. A guy takes a good turn, he makes a good swing, and the golf club should wind up somewhere over here on the left side, right, E?
Mm-hmm, yeah, right? Yeah. Okay. And if you take a big turn, it puts less emphasis on your shoulders and arms.
Absolutely. That's what I'm trying to say. Now, if he makes that turn properly and completes it and not standing at the end of letting the ball go straight up, he's got all that more room to take all of that pressure off the shoulder and or the elbow. And I'm telling you, first pitch I saw, I'm telling you, I said, what the hell is this? I mean, Johnny Sain would have had a heart attack. He may have had one again.
Well, so I think he had some elbow problems last year. Not that would be related to this, but you'd think that when you make a guy your number one draft pick, you're thinking about his entire career, not just what he's doing right now. And does he have the type of delivery, the type of body, whatever it is, that will last over the years? So I assume they already went over that
I suppose what they'll do is they'll cut his turnaround. They'll cut his turn down a little bit. They'll have less movement for him, and quite possibly he can get there. But the good thing about making that complete turn and extending completely and being in the right position is it puts you in a position, number one, you land safely in a position to stop the ball, knock it down. You know, something good can only happen if you're standing at the mound when you're done throwing the pitch. Now you got the ball in front of you. Standing straight up, you do not have anything in front of you except a line drive coming at your knocker.
On a personal note, if we're gonna watch the Tigers, and I will, so I can report on them when they come back. I mean, I'd like to see Casey Mize and Torkelson play.
Me too.
Rather than seeing Nico Goodrum and whoever else that's been around, you know, with 100 lost seasons. But and the interesting thing about Torkelson too, as I said, he's facing big league pitch. I think you said that, Bobby. He's facing big league pitching, and so he could get overwhelmed very, very early. And I don't think we're going to see either of these guys because of that reason.
You don't think so?
I don't know. The hell do I know?
I think they got to play him. I mean, I think to be not outrageous.
I agree with Denny. And Denny, I got a question for you.
Yeah.
You and the great Dizzy Dean were two of the greatest right-handers of your era. You both were 30-game winners, and both of your careers ended way too soon because each of you got hurt, and you had to change your pitching motion. So how much tinkering with a pitching motion do you want to do with any young pitcher when he's already had success, and this is what's natural for him?
He's had success with the talent that he's played against. He's now playing against major leaguers. There is a world of difference between just AAA and Major League Baseball. The intensity is every pitch. It's, you know, in college and high school, you got two hitters maybe in the lineup, maybe three. The other guys are stiffs. In the major leagues, you don't have many stiffs. Seldom do you see a stiff come up there, and there's got to be a reason he's in the big leagues because he's covered all the bases just to get there. And that's what I'm afraid of, that putting them into a high-intensity situation too early without somebody straightening this out can cause a lot of damage. That's all.
That's interesting. Okay, now let's go to my adopted hometown, Eli Zarrett's home area, and Eli Zarrett's favorite team, and that would be, of course, the New York Mets.
Used to be. They certainly aren't now.
Okay, fine. So the Mets had a dress rehearsal on Wednesday, an intra-squad game at Citi Field. And what they did is, as base runners sprinted toward home plate, they had fake crowd noise of people roaring. Yeah. The Mets are among the teams, and the Yankees are too, who are planning to employ piped-in crowd noise in the fan-empty ballparks. They'll also join the cutouts of fans in the stands that are available for season ticket holders and others willing to pay a fee for
$86.
The customized placards. I mean, this is just to add insult to injury. It's like a laugh track on comic shows on television because they think you're too stupid to know what's funny and what's not.
What exactly? Try it. But, you know, I think the overall thing for me when I hear you talk about that is that sports has always been, quote unquote, an escape from what's going on in the real world. And all sports is doing now is showing us how messed up the real world is, where you can't even figure out how to play a baseball game anymore. And the players are wary. I mean, look what's going on. We got crime. We got unemployment. We got fear. We're moving backwards with the coronavirus. We got George Floyd gets killed. Tragically enough, it leads to the Redskins changing their name. It leads to monuments getting toppled. We can't even agree, like I say, on the mask. So the minutiae, the indecision, the groping, the guessing, we're going to have crowd noise. You're not going to look what's going on in college football. Will we play in the spring? Will we play in the fall? Will there be fans? Won't there be fans? How can we bring them back to campus when there's no kids there? It's just such a mess.
It is depressing. We're talking about that before the show started. But what can we do about it? Nothing. So let's not work ourselves up into too great a lather over this because it's out of our control.
I agree. Of course.
But there are two things that I pay some attention to, injuries and things like that. And there's two good signs that the Yankees and the Mets may be at least very competitive this year. Judge now finally over his last injury for the moment. He hit a home run the other day. And I got something to say about him in a second. And DeGrom passed the MRI. They found no problem, no damage. Now, about Judge, he reminds me so much of Frank Howard.
He's 6'6", that's why. 6'7". Yeah,
that's the reason why. Because he's got the biggest strike zone in all of baseball right now, as far as a guy who can hit. And I'm telling you, why they don't get this guy out all the time. His strike zone is like 80
don't
feet
they?
Wide and 80 feet high. It's unbelievable. You can't get this guy out. You're in a ton of trouble.
Do you watch the New York Yankees much? Because living in New York, I do. It's real hard to get him out. Oh, yeah. It's real hard. Yeah.
You know what? When you keep throwing the ball the middle and you keep throwing hanging curveballs, you know, a hanging curveball to him is like 10 feet to you and me.
Yeah. It's interesting. But he's awesome, Denny. He's an awesome hitter.
Really well, we're going to find out. If anybody ever good pitches against him, we'll find out how good he is. No, I like the kid because of the way he's really a good kid. He appears to be, says all the right things, does all the right things, shows up for all the appearances he's getting. Just a good guy. And the game needs that right now.
Yeah, you're right about that. So Eli, and I can't remember why you didn't do this with Denny and me, but you didn't. You had to be somewhere or do something. So just Denny and I interviewed Cowboy Joe West when he had him on the show recently.
Oh, yeah.
Well, I was there.
Remember that?
Yeah, I was there for that.
Were you there, mm-hmm. Joe?
I think it was just Denny and Zoe. Maybe it wasn't.
So anyway, first Joe talking about, you know, people lining up on either side of the COVID-19 and the mask issue. First, he made some controversial comments about the farce that's going on with sports, trying to deal with all this stuff and start up again. Then he dropped out of the coming bastardized baseball season with only like, I don't know, 70 games to go until he became the all-time leader for most games ever umpired in the big leagues, passing Bill Clem. Now, as many as 10 MLB umps this week say they are not going to work these games either. There are 76 full-time MLB umpires. More than 20 of them are over 55. Joe and Jerry Davis, the oldest at 67. So umpires who are deemed at risk, either for their age, health situation, or other issues, can opt out, will continue to get paid. Umps get their salaries over 12 months. Uh-huh. They'd already been paid through April, so why not drop out? You know, go home and sit out on the boat or by the pool and relax.
Yeah, why would you even show up at the ballpark?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, the reality is, any sense.
People are scared, and I don't blame anybody for being scared. The only thing I blame anybody for, only thing in any of this, you're entitled to think whatever you want and make any prediction you want. You just, when you're around me, you got to wear a mask. That's all. Right. Unless I know who you are. And it's very, very disconcerting when people, so I don't blame these umpires at all. Did you hear, speaking of not playing, there's many examples in throughout sports. Did you see the one about the MVP of the WNBA?
Playing
the Deladon,
who was that Travis Deaners who hit that shot. He was a hell of a college player, wasn't he? Yeah. Is that what you're talking about?
No, the women.
That big basketball tournament they had in Travis.
The women.
The women knows what that is.
Bob, anyway, we'll I'm talk sorry. About the ahead. Women. The women.
I was talking about the WNBA MVP, Elena Deladon, who has suffered from Lyme disease, takes 64 pills a day.
Oh,
and
God.
Her doctor said that she shouldn't play. And then the league, she plays for the Washington Mystics, so they wouldn't pay her because a three-man panel of doctors said that she should be able to play, and they caved in. They're going to pay her not to play this year, but it's a good point you make. If you have a choice, why would you? And that's why a lot of people are wondering what they should do or whether they should.
Hey, Brandon, what was that thing I was just talking about where Travis Deaner hit that shot? I'm sure you watched it. That special tournament, the basketball tournament they just had with all these guys who were top college and pro guys, nationally televised.
Was that something you were playing for $1 million or something?
I don't know.
No,
I thought I heard a million dollars.
No, I may not have the right one either.
Yeah.
I was wondering if it was maybe like the big three or something, but I don't know.
I don't know. I have no idea.
Hey, I got a good basketball story since everybody's feeling a little down. You guys remember Mike Longacre?
For the Michigan State. Did he play on the Magic team and the Kelser team?
The Magic Johnson, Greg Kelser, led MSU National Championship team. Of course he did. So there's a great feature on Mike by Kyle Austin on M Live this week. Spent much of his career under Judd Heathcote trying to guard Irvin in practice every day. But he was pretty impressive. So Judd, in fact, began to rely on Mike Longacre for some advice, and he wanted him to go into coaching. Instead, Heathcote ended up writing a letter of recommendation that helped Mike Longacre get into Harvard Medical School. He has spent the last 20 years at Stanford, where he's a professor at the School of Medicine and the co-director of the Institute for Stem Cell Biology.
Yeah.
His work focuses on scarring and how to regenerate skin and improve wound healing. We give so much crap to these alleged student athletes today. Here's a real student athlete, and they are out.
Well, usually the 12th to 15th man on the team has to have a serious way to make a living. And so, Kelser actually told me about Longacre years ago. He had called him for some medical advice and told me that I'd forgot. Meanwhile, a great foursome at Bloomfield Hills Country Club around the block from me this week. A bunch of Spartans came in. Tom Izzo brought all of his coaches in there, about 10 people. And the foursome was our mutual friend, Jim Forrest, and his foursome had, you ready? Izzo, Kelser, and Gibby.
Oh my
what
God.
A foursome.
And you were, who was the fourth guy? You were in that? Did you say?
No, Gibby. I said Gibby. Gibby,
we got Kelser,
Izzo.
We got Izzo.
Jim Forrest, my friend Jim Forrest.
Oh, Jim Forrest. Okay.
Who's a member at the club. But
not the old Detroit sportscaster, by the way.
There was a guy named Jim. Was it Jim Forrest?
Sure.
That's right. WWJ, as I recall, back in the old days.
Well, here, let me give you something to bite on. Kyrie Irving is asking all of the NBA players and searching every one of them and asking them to turn in some kind of a vote that they don't want to play this year. None of them. Jimmy Butler gets whacked by the hotel security the other night because he's dribbling the basketball too loudly. In his suite.
The security guy knocks on the door because they were complaining about the pounding, and he's in full workout gear, sweating profusely. Working out.
I did just see the guy come into the door. One more little tidbit. Everybody around the bubble, the alleged bubble, is calling and reporting these players who are
snitch
out
line.
The snitch line. They got more rats and snitches in Orlando right now than the entire federal system.
Yeah. So there was some, I have no idea who she is, some amazingly hot, young, beautiful woman. She made news a couple of days ago because she came forward and said she has already received, through the internet, numerous invitations by numerous NBA players to come into the bubble.
Yeah.
And I bet they wouldn't be doing 5 feet of social distancing once you got in there either.
I tell you what's funny about that. I was going to mention it in an earlier show, but now you bring it up. Because when I travel with the Pistons, for 6 years. They never put us, the so-called team media and helpers, whatever you want to call us, on the same floor as the players. We were always on a different floor, so we wouldn't see who was coming and going in the various rooms that the players had on their private floor. And I think that's
floor
one of the major
floor schmore. I worked for 9 years with Marv Albert. I didn't travel with the Knicks, but of course Mark did as the voice of the Knicks. Marv did. When Marv traveled with the Knicks, he didn't stay in the same hotel as the team. He stayed off by himself someplace else, and then we found out why.
Why? Sure.
What was going on after that?
Listen, that was going on when I played. I mean, they used to put the players on separate floors than the media. Although the media really didn't get involved in our lives back then because the media was doing more off the court than we were. And, you know, all of the other things that went along with that. But it's that was a crazy time. Charlie Dressen at one time for curfews at night. We were playing in Minnesota, and he said, all right, everybody in tonight by midnight. If you're not in by midnight, $200 fine. And he handed the – and he went to the guy that was running the elevator and gave him a baseball. He says, listen, anybody who comes in tonight after 12 o'clock, would you have him sign the ball for you, and I'll give you the ball. The next morning, Charlie, first thing he says out of his mouth at 10:30 in the morning, because it was an early workout, says, now, I've got an autographed ball here. I want to congratulate you guys. You guys write pretty well this late at night. Huh, guys, all guys? And Sky started to deny it. Well, lo and behold, Charlie does his dissertation about, now I'm going to whack yous. And he says, by the way, we're going to do this again tomorrow. And Norm Cash, the only guy in the room that had the balls to do this, raises his left hand and says, Charlie, I got something to say. I got something to say. And Charlie says, yeah, you'd be the only one, Norm. What do you want to know? Charlie, I don't get through throwing up till about 11.
Yeah, I remember that line from Cash. I don't even get finished throwing up. He had to do something somewhere. It was like at 11.
Well, they had a workout. They called a workout.
Yeah. Then. Yeah. I don't even get finished throwing up till noon.
Along the lines of what you were saying about Marv Albert traveling, it reminded me, Fred McLeod, the late Fred McLeod, our mutual friend.
Good man.
Was very entrepreneurial. So he traveled with the Pistons for many, many years doing the games on cable TV. And he would of course, he could stay at the team hotel. They had to pay for that room. What he worked out was is he got the price of that room that they were going to pay, the team price, and he went to stay at a Marriott. And over the years, he accumulated so many points Fred, for 20 years, flew for free or stayed for free at Marriott's all over the world because he took that step to not just go with the team room. So very entrepreneurial, I must say. Fred, man, you are amazing. You are.
Do you guys remember that amazing? And folks, if you have not read this, I'm sure you can find it easily on the internet. It was an amazing feature in Eli's favorite publication, Sports Illustrated, on the life of Rocky Marciano a number of years ago, and how he had been given these expensive airplane tickets to fly everywhere, fly here, and he always cashed them in. We could fly cheaper on a little private plane. And one of those little private planes, when he could have flown a major airlines, crashed, I guess we were in Iowa or in a farm
Iowa, field, I think it was,
field or something, and Rocky Marciano died as a result of that cheapness. Yeah. But good for Fred.
We got more to talk about here. I want to talk about, we got some fascinating things to look back historically at what happened in this week in sports. But first, I want to remind you.
Oh, wait a minute. So you're prepared today, in other words.
I did fan on that the other day, I admit. Anyway, you should call Luke Nowacki. Understand what's going on in this crazy market of ups and downs, but amazingly enough, ups, and get his expertise. He works for Pinnacle Wealth Strategies. He is our personal wealth manager and the Red Shovel Network. He's got dozens and hundreds and hundreds of clients, and he'll work with you. And he'll work with you for free, at least in terms of giving you a complimentary consultation, answering all your financial questions, letting you make the decision whether Luke is the guy for you. So call him at 248-663-4748. You got to balance this stuff in your life. You got to be ready for future obligations. And Luke Nowacki of Pinnacle Wealth Strategies is the guy you should call again. 248-663-4748. Life happens. Plan for your future obligations. Advisory services are offered through Royal Alliance Associates, Inc. Other marketing names, product service revenues here, independent of Royal Alliance Associates. And David Hall and Hall Financial, they are refinancing like mad because People love him. They're getting five-star reviews all over the place. You can get your home appraised without even having anybody to come in while the COVID is here. And if you refinance right now, you can probably skip a couple of payments. So now's the time to do it. They're working around the clock for you. Fastest service in the business. That's why they got all those home, the five-star reviews. So go to the webpage, Hall Financial, or get started by just calling 248-308-5000. Hall Financial, lower payments, better options, more personal attention. You're listening to the No Filter Sports Podcast, and coming up in about 10 minutes or so, you'll hear from one of the stars of the postseason in 1984, former Tiger John Grubb. Amazingly, 16 years. What percentage of guys do you think get to play 16 years in the major leagues? It's got to be no more than 5%, I would guess.
I wonder what his pension is.
That's well, then he would know. What do you get?
No, listen, he's got a couple. You know, it just depends on how long he waits to use it. But I mean, if he waits, I don't know how old he is right now, but once he turns 65, he's going to get the full bore. That's a lot of money. Six figures.
16 years, I would think.
Oh, yeah.
10 years, you get the full deal if you wait till the end.
I'd like to talk a little bit about this day in sports or this week in sports, some fascinating stuff. In fact, Brandon, you got it ready. This, I guess, was on Tuesday, exactly 50 years ago. I'm sure we were all watching. I know I was in the bottom of the 12th inning. Here's what happened at Riverfront Stadium.
And right into the stretch, looking back and throws up the middle. Throws is on his way around, picked up by Otis. Throws is coming to the plate, throws a throw. He's in. It's all over. The National League wins.
Yes, he separated his shoulder. Fossey did, one of the most famous All-Star game plays. The other one, and that brought up at the time that it happened 40 years before, that was when Dizzy Dean got hit in the knee, I think it was, in an All-Star game and ruined his career.
I thought hit him with a toe or something.
Yeah, it was on the toe. You're right. Hit him in the toe, right, and screwed up his delivery and everything like that. But Fossey was really hurt by the course. Rose said afterwards he was blocking the plate. I had no choice. I couldn't slide, so I did what I had to do. But it was really iconic in that that's the way Pete Rose played, no matter whether it was an exhibition game or whether it was the All-Star game or the World Series. And it was just a
But it was the only way we played back then. They played hard-nosed baseball, whatever you want to call it, and Pete didn't give him a chance. I mean, an All-Star game, you'd think that somebody would try to slide around the play or something. But not Pete is just one of many that would have done the same thing.
Yeah. Okay, so Denny, they've just outlawed that, what, 2 years ago in Major League Baseball? You can't do that anymore. How do you feel about that?
Well, as we know, there's been some mistakes made. Some guys have gotten whacked anyway. I don't know. I mean, I just don't want to see anybody really get hurt badly. But the game is so competitive and so intense, things are bound to happen. So let them play. I don't think you need to keep throwing a rule on every time somebody makes a mistake or somebody gets hit, whether it's football, basketball, hockey, I don't care what it is. Guys are listen, you're running with all that adrenaline, you're intense. You don't even think about hitting a guy. You just hit him and you hope you score.
And I think the rule, let's get the rule straight, because it was very complicated. You can run into the catcher. The thing is, the catcher can't block the plate before the ball comes
to you. You've got to have the ball.
Got to have the ball. And I don't know if Fossey had the ball at that time or not, but Leo DeRocher was the third base coach when I looked at the play and took the sound off there and ran over to Pete, of course, that won the game of the 12th inning. And my Met, Jim Hickman, singled up the middle to send Pete in.
Jim Hickman.
Also, 2 days ago in 1946, Denny's father-in-law, Lou Boudreaux, you ready for this? Hit four doubles and a home run, but they still lost 11-10 to the Red Sox because Ted Williams had three homers and eight RBIs.
Does it say who pitched that day for Lou's team?
No, it doesn't say.
It sounds like
the staff.
I see that. Here's an interesting one, which would be today, July 16th, 1956. The Tigers and Briggs Stadium were sold to Mr. Fetzer for $5.5 million.
What a good man.
He was a very good man, a very interesting guy. I let Jim Campbell run the team. And I tell you, Sparky used to call him Mr. Fester.
Yeah.
He was always Mr. Fester. And nobody ever corrected Sparky to say, no, Sparky, it's Mr. Fetzer. I'm not going to be the one to tell him he's mispronouncing it. And nobody else would either. What else? Dave DeBuscher.
Well, we got the mailbag here, too.
Hold on a second. Listen, you did 8 minutes on the mailbag the other day. I'm up to 2 minutes on this day in sports.
Well, the mailbag's five times better than this segment.
Well, that's your opinion.
That's why we do
this. This is pretty good.
Here's another Denny reference. You already had Lou Boudreaux. Dave DeBuscher on this day in 63 got his only major league base hit off Benny Daniels. And this was the day in 78 that Billy Martin and Reggie Jackson had that famous fight in the dugout. Oh, yeah. Why? Jackson refused to bunt and Martin suspended him after trying to beat him up.
Did you say Benny Daniels?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a name a lot of people don't know. He actually had played in the Negro Leagues. He was one of those guys who came as a right-hand starting pitcher. I remember with the Washington Senators when I was a boy.
Are you sure?
So he actually came up later, yeah.
By 63, man, that would have been at least 15 years. Maybe
well, the Negro Leagues were still
going. Maybe they lasted. Oh, okay. Yeah. Still, yeah. Babe Ruth, tomorrow, 7/18, or maybe in 2 days, hit a 575-foot home run in 1921. Over the fence at Navin Field. It was his 139th home run, which set the all-time record in baseball. 139, beat the record by a Hall of Famer who I never heard of, a guy named Roger Connor, who was put in the Hall of Fame in 1976, played in the 1800s. That's pretty good. Okay. By the way, today was the day that Joe DiMaggio hit for his 56th straight game. Broke the streak the next day, considered the most unbreakable record in sports, although there's many others, right? Nobody's going to win 511 games like
Well, that was a dead ball era too, guys. I mean, they were playing with rocks.
Yeah. Well, Kenny Keltner ended his streak. You remember that? The late Indians third baseman. He made a couple of great plays on balls.
That's right.
That would have been singles or doubles or whatever. Yeah.
And last
right, the mailbag now, right?
Go ahead. That was against Cleveland, right?
You're chasing me off.
Yeah,
go ahead.
Yeah, because Boudreaux was.
No, I'm not. What else you got?
It's okay. You got 4.5 minutes. Knock it out. Let's go.
Wait a second before he goes. There was one other thing I want to point out about Mr. Boudreaux. In the playoff game in 48 before they got to the World Series, Boudreaux, and he couldn't hardly walk. He went out there and played himself, didn't let the substitute play for him. He goes out there, 2 doubles, 2 home runs. They win the ball game. I mean, the guy just was a real man.
Yep. Go ahead.
All right, folks. You want to join the mailbag? You can tweet us anytime you like. That would be at Eli Zarrett, at MU2Denny, or at Bob Page Sports. Rob Viles tweeted on our interview the last show with Kenny Holland. Best interview to date, and that's saying a lot. I loved hearing Holland's stories, especially about his path through the farm systems, being a young married man, and making it to the NHL for good in the front office. I'm grateful for his time with the Wings. Anybody who says one bad word against Mr. Holland is short-sighted and ungrateful for the greatness he brought our beloved Red Wings. Just look at the scouting team that he built as a starter. Parker and the Man, I think most of you folks, at least the Michigan people, you know.
Yeah, Rob Parker and Mark Wilson, yeah.
Well, of course. So Mark Wilson tweeted the other day, I dig the podcast with you three dudes. Denny, you're a dude. Still, did you know that?
But I've always been a dude, Bob.
Okay, so Mark says the podcast is informative and entertaining. I highly, in capital letters, recommend it to all the peeps. Great interviews. Look at me. Propping and promoting the no filter, well worth it though. So when you get this kind of praise from people really in your industry. Yeah.
Well, I worked with Mark, him for some years.
Thank you so much. That was very nice. You know, I love this. God, I love this. I don't know who this is. He just goes by K Turret, T-U-R-E-T. He tweeted me this morning, just in time to make this program. That's Denny's traveling Hammond organ. He posts a nice YouTube pic of Denny at the organ with a link to Denny playing Laura. Now, I fell in love with Gene Perling and the Singers Unlimited's version of Laura years ago. And then there was a movie in 1944. And then Denny went on, this is on YouTube, folks, to play more. An article I also read was entitled, quote, The Swinging Pitcher, a look at Denny McLean's easy listening career. The writer then refers to your playing as, and I'm quoting again, competent but super square. So here's the question I have for you, Denny. In the summer of love, 1967, you were 25 years old. How the hell do you wind up playing?
He's 23.
Often hokey 23. Stuff.
I was 23. 23.
But why were you playing this hokey stuff from the World War II generation?
No, listen, the album was something that was an album based song. The rest of it, what we did was Motown all the time. That's all we did.
Didn't you do The Girl from Ipanema too?
Yeah, we did Ipanema. we did a lot of great stuff, a lot of Broadway stuff too. So, I mean, you know, I can say this. You can laugh all you want. For 27 years, I got $55,000 a year. It wasn't a bad gig.
It's not at all.
And then
in fact,
he would say,
I had another quote from the same article that said, it quoted you. In fact, in 1989, you were playing, and you've mentioned this before, in a bar somewhere in Detroit where Leon Spinks was tending bar, and they quoted you as saying, when I retire, I want people to remember Denny McLean, the musician.
Oh, please.
That's what he said.
I know, you're so
in
full
89.
Of it.
So, well, you know, you say different things at different times.
Because of the same show. Chasing,
and I was trying to do the same thing Leon did, chasing them lamb chops.
At the same time, Denny said, look, I wasn't that great a player, but I was the best 31-game winner who ever played the Hammond Organ.
Well, why did you?
So you're right.
Why did you?
And I'll tell you something else. We had a great, entertaining show. We really did.
Right. Why did you quit playing organ? Did you have arthritis or something in your hands? You don't play anymore, I know.
No, I do play. I play at home a little bit from time to time. But no, I have Sharon. The sicker she got, the less I could travel.
Okay, what else you got? We
got
to say goodbye to our radio.
First of all, from your Elliot's probably pissed at you right now, Eli, one of your best friends. Elliot Lerner last week, Eli would not let me get this on, Elliot. So he wrote, there's a ton of talk about the lost dollars of canceling college sports for the fall and the dire consequences of losing those dollars. Sure. But he talks about the billions of dollars sitting in these university endowment funds. Michigan's got 12.4 billion. And of course, the Ivy League schools, it's astounding what they have. So he says, but am I missing something? Are these dollars being accessed now to help all these college teams that are in such financial trouble? Are these endowment funds subsidizing tuition for the needy? Are they being used to cover sports revenue shortfalls? Elliot, I don't know. I
think all of the above. I think all of the above, because there are many shortfalls at all kinds of schools that not all of them make money because they have to support with Title IX all the minor sports. By the way, I got to say goodbye to WCWA in Toledo, our lone remaining radio holdout here. So thanks for listening.
Only
You've been listening to the No Filter Sports Podcast.
Yeah, I need a couple more. I got a couple more here. Here's Rick Hughes in Sarnia, Ontario, hometown of, I know you know this, the little ball of hate.
Oh, yeah.
Pat Verbeek, the late lamented great guy. Sean Burr of the Red Wings, Dino Ciccarelli is from Sarnia, and guess who else is? The only Canadian to have ever won one of golf's major championships, and you both know who that is.
Mike, what's his name?
Mike Weir.
Won
the 2003 Masters.
Yeah. What happened to that little lefty? I remember him,
Yeah, he's just, he's pushing 50. He's going to clean up on the seniors tour in about 2 years.
Yeah, he should. He was a good player.
Oh, hell yeah. Yeah. So, Rick, anyway, what Rick wrote was, I just wanted to point out that renaming or rebranding a major league sports team is not that unheard of. Remember the Washington Bullets, since known as the Wizards? The name may have sentimental value to some, but team performance is the bottom line. If the team wins, the fans will trip all over themselves just to be part of it. I think he's right.
More than likely.
Redskins people are pissed that they're changing the name, but if they're Washington, whatever they want to call them, if they start, contending again, they won't under little Danny Snyder. But if they do,
where did the name Bullets ever come from? Why would they call them the Washington Bullets? What kind of a mascot is that?
That's a good question. For
all the murders and everything, they
tell you one thing. Over the last year, they've had a lot of bullets flying in that town. You just go back and look at it. They've had a real wild time.
And here's a guy from Chicago and Detroit telling you that, folks.
Yeah.
So
they were rivaling my heroes in Chicago with the cops.
I'm not going to read this letter. I'm not going to read this letter, Denny. I told you I wouldn't. Just Fro Vitale wrote to take big issue with you.
I want to say something to him
COVID-19
too.
COVID-19 and masks.
We want to say something to Vitale.
Yeah. Go ahead.
I did get the baseballs. They're already signed, and they will be on the way today to you, Mr. Vitale.
Oh, good. No, but this is a different guy. I think he pronounces this Vitale. The other one is Dick Vitale's nephew. He pronounces
Well,
it
that's
Vitale.
The guy that sent the balls.
Right. Yeah. So anyway, Chris writes us and says, I think this is more directed at me than anybody. So I'm having trouble listening now because you guys are driving me crazy with the don't start sports talk. He says he has a good job that's dependent on live events and sports is a big part of it. When you say just shut it down, think about all the jobs. There's not going to be a vaccine anytime soon. And we don't have pro sports for 2, 3, 4 years. I understand where you're coming from, but how are you and other ballpark employees like you, whatever jobs you do, How are you going to make any money with no fans allowed inside? So why not shut it down?
And the restaurants too. Everybody, there are tons of support people. I mean, look at the. I was reading, you know, because the tournament in Muirfield begins today. Yeah. All the restaurants and hotels that were counting on this revenue, and nobody's showing up.
And I heard Fauci make a statement this morning about a new company that's just jumped in, a U.S. company called Moderna, and they're supposed to have possibly the solution to the to the overall problem. And they think that this will be out before the first of the year.
Yeah,
that will be nice. Cool. We'll see.
Wouldn't that be great?
So just one quick note in closing the mailbag segment before we get to Johnny Grubb. This is from Mike Vandegenst. He's written this before. He's a retired police officer of 30 years experience. And he becomes rather unglued, that's his term, listening to us talk about all the stuff going on with our policemen and women right now. He just says, you know, I love your show, but please stay off the non-sports topics. So on. It's, I mean,
we don't disparage the police.
The Black Lives Matter and the police issue. But we always talk about the good police officers.
Bob, we don't disparage the police. Never have.
No, yeah, never have. I think he just doesn't like us to mention the issue on the show.
Can't blame him.
I got other cops that I hang around with that love it.
There are no sports to talk about unless we talk about Pete Rose. And other than that, it's, you know, the old days. In other words, it's just what's may or may not happen. And you know, guys missing curfew or leaving the bubble and all kinds of absurdities as far as that goes. So great. Thanks for the mailbag, Bob. And let's talk to our special guest, Johnny Grubb. Well, the Tigers won game one of the 84 ALCS against the Kansas City Royals. Game two, also in Kansas City, was Petrie versus Saberhagen, went into extra innings tied at three. With two out in the bottom of the 10th, the Royals' Steve Balboni off Aurelio Lopez hit what looked like a game-winning and series tying through on homer, but Chet Lemon ran it down at the wall. Then in the top of the 11th, with two on, one out, designated hitter John Grubb faced a 1-2 pitch from reliever Dan Quisenberry.
Stillman at first and second, and Grubb is the batter. Now Evans is at second. Jones is at first. In the gap toward right center field, racing back is Wilson, and it's over his head. At least one run will score as Evans comes around third, and he will score. And behind him comes Jones as the Tigers now lead by two. Johnny Grubb ripping one to the gap for a double in right center.
Wow, what a night. That was 36 years ago, and John Grubb was 36 years old that night as he stood on second base, his heart pounding. Hey, man, how are you? Really glad you could join us and talk about this in your career. Are you good?
I'm doing fine. Thanks, Eli. And just glad to be alive and seeing the health-wise, I'm feeling great. So I can't complain.
Now, when I looked at that and a play again, I was in the press box the night we talked about that. You're on second base, and you're not smiling. You're kind of, your heart is pounding, et cetera. Tell me what was going through your mind. What was the scene like, and what was the bench like, and all that?
Well, I was excited, believe it or not. I mean, I was glad I could do something to help the team win a ball game, and you know, but so I was at second base. I remember I was very happy, and I glanced over in our dugout, and Rusty Koontz, Darrell Evans, all those guys were jumping up there, you know. So I think I gave a little fist pump, but I guess the way I was taught growing up and playing ball that you weren't supposed to show anybody up. So I didn't want to get too excited, but I was happy.
Well, you were the gentleman from Virginia, as Ernie called you. So
sometimes
we wouldn't expect for you to jump up and down and high five everybody and bump them and dump them. You know what I mean?
Oh, exactly. Yeah. We didn't do that back then. And, you know, I think about Hank Aaron when he hit his home runs, you know, he did like all the other pro guys did. They just kind of circled the bases. They, you know, probably felt like the pitcher feels bad enough about it. So, you know, we didn't do much showboating.
Yeah, you had a lot of good players. You had a great bench in 84. Did you guys all get along pretty well?
We did. It was a good group. Everybody got along great, and I think everybody understood what their roles were. Thanks to a great captain like Sparky Anderson, he made sure that everybody understood what their roles were on the ball club. And for us to have a good team, we had to pull together and accept our roles and do what we could do to help win a ball game. And that's what we did.
Johnny, Eli and Denny are making you sound like some kind of laid back, easygoing Southern boy. Truth is, you were a hothead. And when you came out of high school and you got into pro ball, you played at Lodi in California in the Class A League. You threw your helmet after you struck out so hard that your manager, the great Hall of Famer Duke Snyder, read you the riot act and changed your personality. Am I right?
Well, he tried to help me. I put it that way. I punted it. I punted a helmet one time. I remember that in Lodi.
That's how you punted it. Yeah.
Not in Lodi, Alexandria, Louisiana. And I struck out, and I'd get to pinky, as they used to call it, and I'd get mad with myself. And I'd be my own worst enemy sometimes, believe me. And I'd get a little hot-headed and do some stupid things. So I learned over the years from watching other players. I'd watch some of the guys that I respected and looked up to. And they taught me, you know, a lot about trying to not show so much emotion. And so I could be a hothead. That's for sure.
Hmm. Interesting. You know, you played at Florida State. You must have really loved it there because you got drafted by the Red Sox in 69, by the Reds the same year in the first round, drafted by the Braves in 70. Finally, the Padres take you in round three in 71. Round three in 71. No, actually in the first round. But it must have been to have a great time. Why did you turn down three offers before you finally decided to take it and start your pro career?
Yeah, it was a tough decision because I was still married to the same wonderful lady, Linda. We've been married 52 years, I believe it is now going on. And I was married young in college. I would have signed with Boston when I first got drafted, but I had gotten real close to the college coach at Manatee Junior College, Bob Wynn. We call him Skip. And I felt like he was so good to me that I felt like even though I wanted to sign, I felt like I wanted to stay with him and be with the college team. And that was a smart decision on my part because to make that decision at that young age, I had to make a tough decision whether I wanted to sign or stay in college. And Coach Wynn was the reason why I did that. I liked him a lot, and he was good to me and my wife, and I just felt like I wanted to stay with him. So as it turned out, I got signed with San Diego, and they brought me up real quick to the major league. So it worked out good for me. It really did.
Yeah, by the way, I was married 56 years, so you got a few to go yet. You hear? How is life treating you right now? The pension, everything in good place, good order?
It is. I mean, I'm happy with what I get. I'm thankful for what I can get from the Major League Baseball pension. They did a good job for us along those lines as far as what
sure
I get
did.
Each month is something that I can live on and I'm comfortable with. So
are you working at all?
I'm not. When I got out of playing ball, I did I coached a little bit. I went back to my high school where I went to high school. It was for 10 years. I was a baseball coach there at Meadowbrook High School in Richmond. And I did a few other things. I did batting instruction and stuff like that just to stay busy. But the pension is what gets us through. And if I didn't have the pension, it wouldn't be very easy.
You know, there'd be a lot of us under a bridge.
Yeah, it would be tough. It would.
Yeah,
so
sure
I'm thankful
would.
For that.
Yeah. Hey, Johnny, we have a lot of former Tigers on this program, and many of our listeners always say their favorite part of our interviews with ex-Tigers is when we ask all of you guys, as we do, about Sparky. A lot of the guys did not like Sparky. Some of the guys did.
Huh.
What was your relationship with him like? What did you think about him?
I loved him. I mean, he was good to me, and I understood when I joined Detroit, I was at the end of my career, so I didn't know how many more years I had left in me. I was in my late 30s, so I knew I was at the end of my career. So I understood and accepted my role as a pinch hitter DH from time to time. But as far as a person, Sparky helped me, as did many other teammates. You know, they helped show me the right way about going about life and doing things the right way. And Sparky was one of those guys. I think I heard Pete Rose one time refer to him as being street smart. He thought Sparky was street smart. And I took that he understood people and knew how to get along with people and make good decisions. And that's how I viewed Sparky. I thought whatever decision he made, I had confidence in it. I felt like he was making the right decision. And he was a wise man, and I learned a lot from him, from just watching him.
Johnny, in your career, you had 7 pinch hit home runs, right?
You know what? I don't even know.
I do. You remember any of the good ones? I mean, the ones he hit the furthest or the best pitcher you hit one off of?
Oh, geez. I remember
Paul Hartzell, 7-10 for 17 in your career. He was trying to work towards the best.
I'm trying to work towards Bert Blyleven.
I didn't know that. Well, I knew I'd maybe gotten a few off of him, but I was not really a home run hitter. I always viewed myself as a line drive type hitter and tried to, you know, get on base. I don't think I ever remember going to the plate trying to hit a home run. So whatever I got that went over the fence, I feel fortunate for, and because I didn't see myself as that type of a hitter, a home run hitter, you know.
We've had a lot of, but Bob said, we've had a lot of 84 Tigers on the team, on the show. I mean, a lot of goofy guys on that team. Rusty Koontz was a goofball. Marty Castillo was a goofball. Garbay was goofy. And we had Rupert Jones on. We couldn't stop laughing, especially when he insisted on calling Denny Mr. McClain till we made him stop. Who were your pals on that team?
Rupert was funny. I tell you. Dave Rosema was the guy that kept us loose. I think every ball club, I'm sure Dave could tell you that they had him on the 68 team too. You had to have a couple guys that would keep you laughing and keep things loose, because it's a long season. If you get too caught up in stuff and get too anal about things, you know, it would probably make for a long season and not a very fun season. So Dave Rosema was the one that I think kept me laughing hard. And Rupert Jones was funny, and Tom Brookins had a good sense of humor. So we had a good group of guys. We really did. And of course, the guys like Darrell Evans, who was a veteran type guy, kept everybody loose too. So we had a good mix of guys.
I'll tell you, we had the leader of the group, Norman Cash.
Yeah, I heard stories about him. I never got to meet him. I wish I'd have gotten to meet Norman Cash, because he, number 25, was one of my favorite players growing up. He and Al Kaline and some of those guys, but I never got to meet him. And he was a left-handed hitter too, and was a good ball player. So I heard he was a funny guy.
You know, there's one story when he walked up with that piano leg, was classic, classic, classic. And God, he even stepped into the box with it before they took it away from him. It was
Nolan
crazy.
Ryan, right? Hey, meanwhile, you two guys. If this is a true story, tell me, Johnny, you were naturally a right-handed hitter and you switched to bat lefty because of your idol. Mickey Mantle was also Denny's idol. So that was very interesting. Is that true?
Yeah, it is true. When I was a little boy, I used to go ahead and hit rocks in the backyard. I didn't have a whole lot to do, I guess. I'd get the broken wooden bats from Little League guys that would break a bat, and I would get their bats and put a little tacks in and tape it up. And I'd watch the games on TV. I noticed I knew all the Yankees' batting order. Milwaukee, Detroit, all the hitters, I knew they were right-handed or left-handed. Nellie Fox was one of my favorite. He was a little left-handed hitter. So I'd go outside and imitate these guys, and I'd learn just from throwing rocks up in the air to hit. I learned how to hit left-handed, so Mickey Mantle.
I don't understand. What Mantle was a switch hitter. Become a switch hitter then?
But that's a good point.
Great question.
I wanted to. I got to high school, and my high school coach said, "You stay left-handed. Don't be switching around, because I could hit right or left." And to this day, if I hit fungos, I've got to hit them right-handed. I can't hit them left.
Really?
I can hit ground balls, pop-ups,
that's
everything
too funny.
Right-handed. Left-handed, nah. Doesn't work.
You know, Johnny, we wouldn't be talking about you as a role player with the Tigers if you could just bat both ways. Did that ever dawn on you?
It's too late.
Hey, you know what? One time, it was the last game of the season when I was with San Diego. We were playing San Francisco. It was a day game. It was the last game of the year. And I was on the on-deck circle. I looked over at John McNamara. And I acted like I was taking practice swings right-handed, because they brought in a left-handed pitcher, and he was warming up, and I was taking practice swings right-handed. And I looked, and he goes, "Don't even think about it." So I did, but I didn't think about it.
You mentioned how you were a fan when you were a kid and you imitated batting styles. It always struck me, Johnny, I would assume before I got into broadcasting that all, if I was a fan and I could barely play, you guys must've been super fans, but very few players I noticed were really intense fans. And on the 84 Tigers, I knew Trammell was a huge sports fan of all sports. Did you ever notice that too? Cause not a lot of guys you played with were really serious sports fans, even though you did it for a living.
I did. I knew that Allen loved his basketball team. I think the Lakers, if I remember correctly. And most athletes love other sports. I really got into golf. I like golf a lot. And, I, of course, I went to school with Lanny Watkins and Bobby Watkins. So I kept up with their careers. And I love golf a lot. But and golfers love baseball. You know, they somehow like baseball a lot. So I think most athletes enjoy watching the other pros in other sports, and they recognize how much work it takes to get where they're at and how talented they are to be able to stay there. So I knew Allen was a big fan of other sports, and Allen was the best. I'm telling you, Allen and Lou were the best double play combination I've ever seen in the game. Day in, day out, I think they were the best ever. So both of them were great ball players.
And Whitaker's not in the Hall of Fame.
I think he should be, but it would have been great had they put them both in together because, like I said, they're the best I've ever seen. I think Sparky asked me one time, we were eating breakfast, I think he leaned over and said, Grubby, have you ever seen anybody in the game that were any better than Allen and Lou? And I said, absolutely not. I can't think of anybody that were better double play, second base shortstop combination than those two guys. And they both put up great numbers, so it would have been great to see them both go in together in the Hall of Fame, but it didn't work out that way.
Now, you played in the Mexican League at one time, right? In a winter ball?
I did for 2 years. Went to Obregon, Mexico.
Yeah. Tell everybody what the wonderful conditions are like down there.
You know what? I've gotten so old, I don't know if I can the only thing I can remember, Denny, on that was the food. The teammates and the ball and everything, that was, I mean, no problems there at all. I felt great that I could play, you know, in winter ball and get a little more experience and maybe get on fast track to the major leagues. But, but you know, I remember the food and I remember the bus rides. The bus rides were
terrible,
actually scary. Yeah, pretty hard.
Wasn't the food good? Mexican food's delicious. You didn't like the food?
It was.
Can I say one thing? They brought me down there, and I spent a week in Mexico. The 1 year I was suspended in 1970, and they hit me on a bus for a week, and they let me travel with them for a couple of games. And I want to tell you something: everything that come near my body turned colors. Well, I can tell you, I've never seen so many beans in one country in my life.
I tell you what, you know what scared me is how it. We would travel on those dirt roads and around mountains and everything, and these guys were terrible. Making passing vehicles, and I'm thinking, how do they know what's coming around the other side of the mountain there? You know, we're going to have a head-on collision here. But there was some – most players will tell you the same stories, but the food was good. Actually, we had a I think the restaurant was called El Bronco or something like it. It was a steak place, and they had great steaks, and the people were so good to me. In Obregon, I'm talking about the citizens there in the city, and then of course the teammates and the manager and everything. I had good experience, other than I got sick a couple times there and there with food poisoning, but the food was good. Well, actually, the food was good.
Well, Bob, and I'll get out of your way here. That week I spent down there, I was told on the first or second day that, in fact, be careful what you eat because some of the meat may be dog, not steak.
Jesus.
So it made me move from the front of the bus to begin with to the back of the bus. And number two, I never had another piece of anything for the next 6 days. I can tell you that. I didn't want anything to bark.
Oh, hey, Johnny, I want to ask you about pitching. I want to ask you a couple of questions. First of all, who were the greatest pitchers you ever faced in your era? What guy could you just not get a hit off of no matter what? And what guy did you own? He could never get you out.
Oh, those are good. I have to think. Well, the first one's pretty easy about which one was the toughest. Nolan Ryan was the toughest on me, and I was a left-handed hit. I saw the ball well. You know, it wasn't like I wasn't picking the ball up. He just made some tough pitches, and the guy had great stuff. I mean, he was tough on me. So Nolan Ryan would have been the toughest for me. The guy that I hit the best, there were some pitchers that I felt – some pitchers with Boston, and I don't know specifically which names, but I always seemed to hit Boston well and their pitching staff. Baltimore, I did pretty well against the right-handed pitchers. Another guy that gave me a heck of a time was two of them, Gary Lavell and Ramon Hernandez. They were both left-handed pitchers, had kind of a different kind of release point, threw pretty well, and you run across some of those guys that just you have a hard time with. Dan Quisenberry would get me out. I'd hit him hard, hit the ball hard, but it always seemed like it would be at somebody. And so I felt like I hit him pretty hard, but I would go back to the dugout, you know. So he did his job. He'd get me out. So that one game where I actually got a hit against him, it was like overdue, so to speak.
He hit it 400 feet to center field. It was pretty good. By the way, I said it earlier. Whether you remember him or not, he went 10 for 17 off Paul Hartzell, who I don't remember, but that was the guy that you hit the most. Hey, Johnny, you played 16 years, but you're on the disabled list 9 times, cost you so much playing time. What were the nature of those injuries, and are you at all physically hampered by them so many years later?
I'm fine now. From all the injuries I had, it's the worst thing an athlete can go through. Being in a slump is probably one of the worst things, but you know, you're in a batting slump or fielding slump or whatever, it's a tough thing to go through. But when you physically hurt, it's nothing you can do about that. So I had some broken bones, separated shoulders. I think one time I bruised a kidney in Texas that sidelined me for a while. But I had some freaky little injuries, like a break a finger on my hand. You can't play with a broken finger and do very well hitting. I want to say I had some freaky injuries, you know, that I'm a small boned person, so maybe when I weighed 160 pounds, Eli, I didn't get hurt. I never saw a training room, but when I got over 200 pounds, I started to get some of those things started showing up. I'd have some of these freaky injuries, but that's the worst.
Well, the longer you play, the more
16 years. Wow.
Yeah, 16 years is a long time. How about people, if you were in a bad way, bad streak, you weren't really hit the ball that well, you weren't on top of the ball and getting it in play the way you wanted to. Was there anybody you ever went to and asked them on the club for some help?
Not really. And that's probably one of the things I would have change advice that I would give to a young person is that I was such a hard-headed person. I thought I could figure it out myself, and I'd beat myself up and go into mood swings and get a little mad with myself. Sure. And I think I would have been a better teammate, a better ball player, if I would have not had so much pride and maybe gone to someone and sat down with them and say, hey, you know, tell me what you see and see if we can get this. But I was hard-headed. I was going to figure it out myself, you know. and in the meantime, I could be probably a miserable person to be around when I'm not hitting the ball well. So that's the truth. And
still married 52 years later.
That's right. Still married 52. That's amazing.
I'm sorry.
Hey, Johnny, I just have – go ahead.
Last one from me. A big rap on people across the entire sports world as well. He's a choker. He doesn't play under pressure. He doesn't play well in the postseason. He goes belly up in the World Series. You hit 429 career postseason in 3 different series with Detroit. Was your mindset just different? How did you deal with the pressure of the playoffs and produce the way you did?
Well, A lot of producing, whatever job you're in, it has to do with confidence and being, you know, sure of yourself, so to speak. And know you put the work in, you feel like you almost like you deserve to do well. And so I think anytime I went into any kind of a postseason play, I felt like I had done a lot of work. I felt comfortable with that. I wasn't backsliding in any way. I was going to do my work and put the work in. And I felt like, you know, heck, somebody's got to do it. I felt confident when I went up against the pitcher. So I think it, most of it is confidence.
Tell me, this will be my last one. What do you think of the current things that are going on in this crazy game? And I know none of us can look into a ball and say, hey, this is what's going to happen the rest of the year. You get the sense they're going to get the 60 games in or not?
That was kind of a surprise to me because, you know, I thought that wasn't that long ago. Someone had told me, I don't know who it was, but it made it sound like the season was going to be lost. But now it looks like they may be able to get some of the season saved, 60 games. I hope they do. I hate to see the whole year go by without any Major League Baseball being played. The fans, I know, miss it, and I do. You want to see them get back on the field playing, but of course, safe, their health and everything is first on everybody's mind. You want to make sure that nobody gets sick, but I hope they do. I hope they get back to playing and that the owners and the players can save a little bit of this great game for part of a season anyway. It would be nice.
Now, yeah, could you imagine hitting if you had to? I mean, I know there's no rule that they have to, but could you imagine hitting a baseball with a mask on? You're going to see guys have masks on, pal.
Oh, really?
You know, it's a plate. Tell you what, deal with the other problem, the distancing between the catcher and the hitter.
Yeah, well, that's why we have to see how it plays out. We have no idea, but yeah, it's going to be. So here's my last one. Before you came on, John, I was talking, we were previewing having you, and I talked about that moment after you hit the two-run double against Quisenberry. You won game two, and I go to the elevator in Kansas City, and Denny didn't believe me, but Jim Campbell and Bill LaJoy were virtually running down the hallway, and Campbell was like a little kid. Here's a guy that I rarely saw smile, if only for a second or two, and was like a child who had just gotten a pony for Christmas. And Bill LaJoy traded for you. He traded Dave Tobik, who had been the number one draft choice to the Rangers, for you. What was your relationship with those guys? And maybe talk about how Bill LaJoy built that 84 team. He made every trade, drafted all those guys. Pretty amazing. What was your relationship with those guys?
Well, Mr. Campbell, I don't remember meeting that often or knowing that well, but Bill LaJoy always gave me the impression that he was in my corner and was, you know, pulling for me, and I'm sure Mr. Campbell was too, but I just felt like I knew Mr. LaJoy a little bit better, and I'm just glad to hear the story that they were that happy, because I know that's got to be a tough job for a GM and for the front office people to make tough decisions. I know Sparky probably had a lot to do with their decision making, because I mean, they put together a great team, I know that, and they had the right mix of guys. I mean, when you got somebody like a Gibby that will just absolutely run you over to get to home plate, and and other guys on the team, that it starts rubbing off on you, and you start playing that same aggressive style of baseball. And I think they put the right guys together. They had leaders, and they had guys that were willing to accept their roles and do what they had to do.
They sure
that
did.
Was your championship. You played 16 years. It was the only title you had. And as I said, I think that winning that game two in Kansas City, because they were a tougher team for you guys to face than San Diego, was the key hit and the key win in all that postseason. And great memory sharing it with you. Thanks for joining us, Johnny. Great to talk to you again, man.
Take care and stay safe.
You're welcome. You guys have a great one, and stay healthy, and y'all take care.
You too. Okay. Thanks, John.
See you, Johnny.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Great. Bye-bye. Great stuff.
And that was great talking to Johnny Grubb, obviously. And thanks for joining us today, everybody. We'll see you again on Monday for another edition of No Filter Sports.
Thanks, everybody. Have a good weekend.
Have a great weekend, everybody. Please stay safe. And there's nothing wrong with the mask.